There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1104, July 21st, 2025, Stephen.
This is F1 Weekly Podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com webster for the ads that interest you. From Danica's tantrums to Danny's smiles, Yahoo Ads give you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. So, no race this weekend. A bunch of crap, really, but no news is good news, so we're just going to go right into quick shots here. I hope Mick Schumacher goes to Cadillac along with Perez. Nothing else. Max is staying where he needs to stay. And I'm going right to Nasser Hamid's corner. We've got Brad Spurgeon, F1 journalist for the International Herald Tribune. And due to the 10-year anniversary of losing Jules Bianchi, we will play the interview from Hockenheim with Nasser Hamid and Jules back in the day. And yes, we do need your contributions, ladies and gentlemen. Those keep us up on the cloud so you could download us and listen to us. So please just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. And don't forget, Nass, I think about you every day.
Please introduce what could be a very successful race driver.
Well, he already is. Well, as you know better than anybody, Grand Prix motor racing started in Vive la France. But unfortunately, since 1950, there has been only one French world champion, Monsieur Alain Prost.
Yeah, that's a big bummer.
Yeah, but he won four times, so he made up for Gerrier and Tambay and Arnoux. But I have a very strong feeling that number two, deuxième Français world champion, I'm getting there, will be Jules Bianchi. Okay, I met him last year, courtesy of my friend Mr. Olivier Menu, who also arranged this interview, so my thanks to both of them. Of course, like most racing drivers, Jules started in karting, was very successful, which was confirmed by Valtteri Bottas when we played his interview last week. When I asked him who were good competitors for you, he said Jules was, you know, in karting also very good. Came into motor racing. And last year, he was teammate in the ART team to Nico Hülkenberg and won the F3 Masters, Zandvoort famous Masters race. So it was very, very impressive. Won other races also. And this year, he was on fire. Won a lot of races. And he also won the feature race at Hockenheim, where I was there, the season finale. Very nice kid and very polite. And I wish him all the best. And now, of course, he is signed with, he's going to stay with ART. And going to GP2 next year, and I fully expect him to win races and make an impact in his rookie season. And he's also doing a test with Ferrari Formula One team, so which is all indications are that he is on his way. And hopefully he will be one of the first drivers in Formula One where we will have an access and go and talk to him a little bit. So I would like to thank Jules Bianchi very much, Olivier Meunou very much, and I hope everybody enjoys this conversation. And we will see Jules again at the races next season. Merci.
Okay, folks, I'm in the press room of Hockenheim Ring with a young gentleman from Vive la France who has just won the race and is also the 2009 champion F3 Euro Series. Jules, welcome back to F1 Weekly. What is the feeling of winning the championship and the race?
Well, I mean, it's a really good feeling for me. After Dijon, we did a really good job. To win here in Hockenheim was really special for me, because after the first race in the beginning of the season was a bit difficult. Remember, I finished P5 and P3, and we were not really fast. So to win today, it's really important for me and for the team. We also won now the driver championship and also the team championship. I think it's over. I'm not sure, but I think it's finished now. We won, so it's really good for everybody.
Now, Dijon, of course, is in your home country. What was the feeling like? What was the first thing you thought of when you took the checkered flag at Dijon Prix Noir?
I was not realizing what that was finished. You know, was over the championship. I just make a really good race, starting P7 and finish P1. It was just great for me. I was just so happy.
Dijon Prix Noir is very famous for what happened there 30 years ago. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not sure.
Okay, the Gilles Villeneuve and René Arda. Have you ever watched that on YouTube or a video?
Yes, of course, I saw it. Everybody saw it and was very special. And it's a really good track. It's just a fantastic track, really fast. And you can overtake, and as you see, 30 years ago, you can overtake. So it's really good.
Okay, 2009 was your second year in F3 Euro Series. You had a big win last year in the Masters of F3. What was the most important thing you learned last year that helped you win? I wrote down 8 races, but now it's 9 races.
Yes, I mean, I improve a lot about my concentration, about to stay calm when I'm not in position to win the race. You know, when I am like P3 or P4, I just stay here and wait to take points for the championship like I did in the first race here. And last year was my problem because I just wanted to win too much, so I did so much mistake.
Okay, last year your teammate was Nico Hülkenberg, who did win the championship. How was your working relationship with him, and did you learn anything from him?
Yes, of course, I learned a lot about driving style, because you, as you know, I think you can see all the data of the other driver of each team. Not each team, but I mean ART can see all the data of ART team, and everybody is like that. So last year I look a lot of his data, and I improve about this, but I was not speaking too much with him, because you know, when you are really close between two drivers, it's difficult to be friends.
Okay. Now, this year you had 3 rookies, very promising rookies, just like you were very promising last year. Is pressure from within a team good for the driver, or would you prefer pressure from another team?
Oh, of course, it's good to have a good driver in my home team, in the same team, because after that you can look at the data, you can improve. You can improve yourself, so for sure it's better to have a good driver in your team than not a good driver, because you improve so much.
The first preseason testing took place in Estoril, Portugal, and you had the fastest time on both days. Did that give you high confidence for the championship this year?
Yes, of course, the test helped me a lot. We did a really good job. We work a lot. We test a lot of things in Estoril and also in Valencia. So for sure, was the most important thing is to get the championship well prepared. You know, if you arrive in the first race and you are well prepared, for sure you will do first part of the season really good. So you have to arrive well prepared, and we did it. We was really good prepared for the first race. I mean, normally yes, but for sure we had a problem in a rear bump in Hockenheim first race. So it's for that we were not really fast. But we were prepared enough, so it was good.
You took pole position for the 2009 Masters of F3 at Zandvoort, but then you were given a 5-grid penalty. How disappointed were you, and do you think the penalty was justified?
I mean, of course, I was a lot disappointed, because nobody won two times the Masters. So I was a lot disappointed, because we did a really good job. We made the pole position, so I cannot say nothing because the marshal decided like that. What can I say? Yes, of course I was disappointed, but they did our job.
Did you cry?
Yes, of course.
Okay, good. Nice to know you're human. Okay, Zandvoort was also the place where you scored your first pole position of the regular season. What was the reason for winning races but not pole till round 7?
Because, I mean, maybe a bit of bad luck in qualifying. Of course, in Nürburgring I had bad luck because the track was drying. And Alexander Sims makes the pole position in the last lap. So, for sure, no racing was like that. But I was all the time P2 or P3, so I was not far. And then in Zandvoort, everything was going really well. And I wanted to take my, how you say it, after the master, you know. I was angry, so I wanted a lot to win here. And I just push and work a lot with my engine.
Okay. You won both races, going back to Zandvoort. Saturday win was special, as it was 100th win for Mercedes-Benz in F3 Euro Series. Did you get a big hug from Norbert Hogg?
Not a hug, but for sure we spoke together, and it was really, really good to meet him.
Okay. What were some of the best moments and highlights and lowlights of this season?
For me, the best moment was Zandvoort. Because I won two races in the same weekend, same meeting, so was for sure the best moment of the season.
Okay. Among the competitors, there are several young drivers who are pretty good and fast here. Who impressed you most, and who was the biggest surprise for you in terms of speed among the other drivers?
For sure, Valtteri was really impressive this year. He did a really good job. He finished, I think, he will finish P3 in championship. It's not sure yet, but normally it will do it.
Will you help him?
I'm not like that. It's not my goal. If I am behind him, for sure I will not brake so late and crash with him, but I will do my race and I will not look at everybody because it's so difficult to do that.
But if you're leading and he's trying to win the race, you're going to say to him, adieu à la nuit?
Yeah. No, for sure I will not let him win the race if I am first and he is second. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Now, separate issue. As a racing driver, you know what happened with the Piquet situation in Singapore. First of all, when you first heard it, did you believe it? And what's your thought on it?
No, I didn't think it was true. I just think it was bullshit. But at the end, it's true. So I don't understand that. It's his decision. So nothing to say.
Okay. Are there any team orders, not to crash, but during the regular season with ART between drivers? Does the team issue any orders, or are team orders allowed in F3 Euro Series?
No, it's not like that. The team, yeah, for sure, Frederic Vasseur come to see each other before the race. Like today, we were P1 and P2. We were racing for the team championship, so he come to us and say, be calm, don't crash together, and that's all.
Okay. Your dad runs a kart track in Brignoles. Do you race there when you get a chance?
Yes, I raced there. I raced there 2 years ago because there were racing 1-5, you know, the gearbox karting. And now I'm not racing anymore because it's too dangerous to make racing karting. If I crash and if I break my arms or something like that, it's dangerous. So I just train and just play, have fun.
Okay. You are now headed to GP2 with the same team, ART. Two questions. What is the goal for 2010? And will the physical preparation change much from F3 Euro Series?
The goal for sure will be to win the championship. I will go there to win the championship. I know it's going to be really difficult because it's a really high-level championship, like in F3, but it's even more difficult with the pit stop and everything you have to improve, you have to learn. New things, pit stop, and the clutch, hand clutch. So for sure it will be difficult, but I will try a lot, I will work a lot in the test in Paul Ricard, and also in the test of the first test of the season next year. And for sure I will change my physical preparation because it's a lot more difficult to drive a GP2 car than an F3 car.
Your teammate from last season, Nico Hülkenberg, also with ART, won the championship in GP2 this year. Was that a surprise for you?
Not really. I mean, I knew that he was really fast, so it was not really a surprise for me.
I would love to see you win GP2 in your rookie season. Okay, in 3 years you have won 2 championships. What is the advice you will give to young kids who are in karting these days? What steps should they do once they get into single-seaters?
I think if they really want, they will do it. So they just have to be concentrated and to do their best, to work a lot on physical part, because it's really important to learn English, as I still do, because my English is not really perfect and I have to improve everything. So just believe it.
Man, you can say bullshit, so you're doing pretty good in English.
Thank you.
Okay, you have always raced with French teams. Do you think when you drive for a non-French team, it would pose a new challenge for you? I'm talking about English also.
Yes, of course, it will be a new challenge for me to speak, to know the technical words and everything. For sure, it will be a challenge, and it will be, of course, better for me for the future.
Okay, I understand you also like football. What is your favorite team, and who is your favorite player?
My favorite team is Marseille. It's a French team. And then my favorite player is, I think, Zidane.
Is Zinedine Zidane?
Yeah, it's not playing anymore, but he is the best.
He is. And he let the Italian team also know that.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, message for listeners of F1 Weekly, please. We report on all your success, and you have a good following on our podcast. How about a message for them, please?
Just thank you to follow me, and I hope I will see you in the track maybe in the future.
Oh yes, I'll be waiting for that invitation for a Formula One race from you. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks to you.
Jules, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
Hi everyone, this is David Malukas, driver for Dale Coyne Racing with HMD Motorsports, and you are listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
We've got an interview with a famous Formula One journalist.
That is correct, sir. My thanks to Mr. Brad Spurgeon. He is a writer for New York Times and also International Herald Tribune, which is the sister publication in Europe of New York Times. Brad is from Canada and has been covering motor racing for quite a few years, and obviously living in France, so fluent in French. And interestingly, that was very, very impressive. Yeah, I was just talking to him about different drivers, and Jean-Éric Vergne's name came up, and he was telling me, and it's in this interview where he was partnered with Jean-Éric Vergne when Jean-Éric was 16 years old in a karting event, and this combo won that karting event, so that's pretty interesting. And of course, he will be going to all the races. It's a one-hour conversation. Thank him very much for his time, and hopefully we will be able to chat with him again.
Okay, folks, today we welcome Brad Spurgeon, an F1 reporter for International Herald Tribune since 1993 and New York Times since 1997. Brad, welcome to F1 Weekly. How is life in Paris today?
Great. It's extremely cold. so it's a good thing, actually, that I have my Canadian background, that I can walk out in this kind of weather, you know?
Yes. And talking of Canadian background, what part of Canada are you from?
I'm from Toronto, although I grew up a little bit in Ottawa as well.
Now, you were at the very first Canadian Grand Prix in 1967 as a 9-year-old. What do you remember most from that race won by Jack Brabham in his own car?
Oh, it's all very atmospheric. I remember, the images are just rushing back to me now. I remember, you know, cars leaping into the air on the track. I remember the people like, I think Jackie Stewart was at that one as well. I later saw him 2 years later at race. I was a fan of Denny Hulme, at the time. Rain is one of the things I really remember, which is kind of interesting, because I went to the race with my dad in his old MG Midget, and I remember the drive was only about an hour and a half, but it seemed like it took forever, and there was rain pouring down and I think leaking in a little bit in the windows, and it had rained during the race. And it was an interesting race, but it was also so new for me. It was like overwhelming sort of emotions and atmosphere of but totally different from the kind of thing that it has become today. You know, it was all sort of campground like, with tents and. Spectators could get really close to the track. You could walk through the fields near the track. It was, these are the sort of things I remember. I remember at the victory, sort of people standing all around the winner. You know, it was all much less ordered than it is today.
Now, Jim Clark, Jochen Rindt, Bruce McLaren, Graham Hill, they were all in this race. Did you happen to have a close encounter with any of these legends of the sport?
No, I did not. But funny enough, I found out after the race that a classmate of mine, so I was, in grade school, his father was in the race. This was Epi Wietzis, was the Canadian driver. He raced in two or three Canadian Grand Prix, and that was one of them. And I was friends with his son, and his son used to take me to sort of poke our nose in the garage door of his house in the neighborhood where we lived to take a look at his racing car up on blocks. It was that was a Lola. It wasn't the Grand Prix car. I think he was he rented a Brabham for the race. He certainly did in the 70s. So I actually, it turned out, had met one of the Canadian drivers. He was the dad of a friend of mine.
yeah,
but no, I didn't meet any of the other people.
Okay, now we, as you said, we live in a very different world now. I heard Betty Hill say that she had to go through Williams' PR department to get to her own son Damon when he was driving for them. How is the access for media personnel to drivers these days?
Well, I think it's very, very good. It depends on the driver. It depends on the driver. It depends on the team, because basically, when you're an accredited member of the media, you're walking around in the paddock, you've got access to this. You're in the same world that the drivers are in, that the teams are in. You can't get any closer. So you're rubbing shoulders with the drivers. You can, sometimes at the end of the day, when their work is done, they'll come out and stand around in the paddock and talk to their friends and, to talk to journalists in a casual way. Obviously, the journalists also have direct access throughout the weekend at appointed media hours, where you go and sit at a table and speak to the journalists in groups. You can organize. So actually, Damon Hill would have been accessible sitting at a table talking to the media. But of course, that wouldn't be the greatest way for his mother to speak to him. It does change from team to team. So you'll have at certain drivers who are at a certain team. Let me try and think of an example, because each team has its own way of presenting the drivers to the media. So at Renault, people, or now Lotus, people will sit around, the drivers will sit at a table, and you'll go and sit around the table face to face with the driver. At Mercedes, they like to put a microphone, sit the drivers at one end of the motorhome, and the media sits opposite at the other, and they pass around a microphone to the media, and the drivers have a microphone. It's like a press conference situation. Personally, I really far prefer the situation where you're sitting around a table chatting with the driver, as opposed to the formal situation of having the driver with a microphone and the media with a microphone, etc. Other teams like the former Lotus, now Caterham, also have the table situation. There's a few little variations on these things, but a lot of it depends on how in demand the driver is. So somebody like Michael Schumacher, somebody like Well, the Ferrari drivers, this is another situation where you've got a kind of a press conference situation with the driver sitting with a microphone at one end of the motorhome and the media gathered all together in a sort of auditorium press conference type of situation with their microphone. Part of that is because these drivers are so solicited that their teams like to organize it very tightly, so they've got X number of minutes with the media. Not too close. It's all very well controlled. Depends on the situation.
I once asked Matt Bishop when he was at F1 Racing Magazine to name the good guys, the drivers who were cooperative to media people, and those who were not, the buttheads. Who would you put in each category?
Oh, boy.
And let me just help you out. He told me there is one driver who will remain at the, who was at the top of the butthead category will remain so today and tomorrow, and that was Eddie Irvine, in his opinion.
Who told you that?
Matt Bishop. That was his opinion.
Okay, because I actually love to interview Eddie Irvine. Eddie Irvine was very, very cool because, I mean, especially at the in his days at Jaguar, because that was a situation where Jaguar would. You just come in, sit at a table, and you fire your questions sitting, you know, side by side, face to face, all that kind of thing. The thing that was great about Eddie Irvine was that whether he really had anything, let's say, extraordinary to say or not, he would say something. And it would often be quite, you know, opinionated. It would be extensive. It would be quotable. So, yes, you could get a feeling of a certain amount of arrogance. And you could get a feeling that if he didn't like your question or thought it was silly, he was going to respond in like manner. He was always a good guy for a good, interesting quote. And he was the exact opposite of everything that has gone wrong with big money F1 in terms of media access and drivers. You know, I'm talking about the kind of automaton robot-like responses from drivers who don't want to upset their sponsors or their teams are perfect corporate employees. Now, Eddie Irvine didn't care about that. And there's a few others like that. There was Jacques Villeneuve. There is even, you know, Mark Webber is another one who is really good to interview because for the most part, he speaks his mind and comes up with interesting and thought out responses. And he's very easy to talk to and accessible. Personally, I don't find that many drivers who are not cooperative, but rather those who are perhaps not very good speakers, not very interesting, and a little bit too conscious of keeping their mouths shut, you know? And so there's certain ones you just get nothing out of, whereas there are others who are favorites you go to because you know they're going to speak, they're open, they're interested, they're natural, they have a lot to say.
Yeah, the Mark Webber statement, not bad for a number two, was classic.
Yeah, that of course was in the post-race press conference. That's a kind of different situation too, because that's the FIA press conference, which is very formal because it's within the media center, in a press conference room with television cameras or FIA cameras. An auditorium situation. What's interesting about that is, as much as there are journalists who do not thrive in that kind of situation, there are also drivers who don't thrive in that kind of situation. And I find that one of the most interesting cases is Michael Schumacher, who, in fact, came across throughout his whole career as being somewhat arrogant and dismissive and curt and not necessarily very good with the media. But that was almost invariably in the press conference situation. And I think it's got to do with his natural timidity. And it's a different Michael Schumacher that you see in front of 50 people in a press conference to the Michael Schumacher that you see face-to-face with you on a one-to-one interview. And the guy that you see face-to-face to you in a one-to-one interview is 100% there, like he is as a driver and everything. He will listen to the questions and give the best response he can. He will take interest in you. There's a certain humility and modesty that comes out of it. You know, I'll never forget that the first time I interviewed him face to face was 1996. No, 98? I've forgotten the year. It was testing with Ferrari. It was at a testing session with Ferrari in Monza. At the beginning of the interview, I said something about my little boy. Ah, yeah, it would have been who was just starting go-karting or thinking of starting go-karting. He never did do it. And we just mentioned a few things briefly. I was chatting and trying to warm up and whatnot. At the end of the interview, he said, well, good luck with that boy of yours. And it was that little touch of the guy remembering 40 minutes later and coming up with that little thing. Very professional, but very 100% there. Now, his brother, who came across on the television as being all that nice little baby brother boy of Michael's, go easier going, et cetera, that wasn't the same person in a one-to-one interview as he was in a press conference or on television. He was much less there. There was quite a touch of arrogance there that I didn't find in Michael. So it's interesting how those situations can change the image to the public and the media, depending on whether it's in a press conference situation or a one-on-one interview kind of thing.
Anybody I have spoken to, and now includes yourself, who has worked with Michael Schumacher or dealt with Michael Schumacher, this includes engineers from Bridgestone, Matt Bishop, and some other people, even some fellow drivers, they have nothing but very good thing and positive things to say about Michael. So you're right, you know, some people just don't. How about our man, Kimi Raikkonen? How is he once you serve him a couple of Finlandia or Grey Goose and try to do an interview?
Well, I've never done an interview with him with any alcohol. But he's obviously a curious case because I quite like Kimi. You can see that you can pierce through that armor of that protective shell or whatever that shell is around him. It's probably not even protective. It's just this permanent shell. It's one of the things that makes him such a different driver is this thick skin and this, he'll never be ruffled, you know? So you can pierce through it. You can get some funny lines out of him. You can get some funny reaction. You can feel a kind of camaraderie, etc. As much as I like Kimi, from a journalistic point of view, I don't want to see him winning races. In terms of the reporting that I have to do afterwards, when he's not going to say anything, and we won't be able to understand what he says when he says it in the press conference situation. He is not, you know, compare that to Sebastian Vettel, who has got to be the most loquacious of our winners in recent years. I don't think I've heard anybody who talks as much as he does, and does it well, expresses himself, you know, as much. Kimi is as he appears, you know, doesn't like to talk much, doesn't have huge external, you know, expressive emotional reactions to things. And unfortunately, that doesn't make for great copy.
No.
But I do like the guy.
Today he's setting the pace in testing early days, though. Your thoughts on how he will do this season?
I mean, it's really hard to tell. Let's say that to be on top right now already certainly looks like a surprise. Having said that, this is the first day of testing, and, you know, we don't know what to read into it at this point, because although occasionally we've seen, you know, the bronze coming out in 2009 and being the fastest right off, I think, and throughout the winter testing. But I think we need to give it a little bit of time, obviously. I think that Kimi, the irony here, for me, the irony of Lotus choice in Kimi is that I think that once Kubica had got, you know, off the scene there, they were desperate to find a driver to lead the team. And in the same way that Ferrari wanted a driver to lead the team, and they had Kimi, and it didn't do the trick, so they went for Alonso. Now, Kimi, I think, is obviously a great driver, fast, tough as nails, but I'd be very surprised if he's the kind of driver who's capable of leading a team. And especially when the team is having, of course, it depends what team too. Some teams don't want leading. You know, Williams back in the early mid 90s, I don't think needed a driver to lead the team. They just came up with the best technology they could, gave a winning car to the driver. Kimi, I think if the car is good, he's a winner. If the car and things are going well for the team, they've got a great driver, they got the driver they need, they're going to win. But I think that if there's a lot of teething problems, if there's a lot of work to be done on the car, Kimi's attitude could become, he could become discouraged pretty quickly and probably close up. And that's not necessarily the best thing for the team. But one of the things I always think of, you know, how one of the great gifts of Michael Schumacher was his ability to stay positive all the time through years and be constructive and positive. You had, and that helped the team, and the team moved forward and developed, and, you know, I think was inspired by that, whether it was Ferrari or Benetton, or, but, and he's doing the same thing at Mercedes. Of course, he could deliver in those days too. You know, they always knew that he was going to be the fastest guy and make the car go as fast as possibly could. Somebody like Jacques Villeneuve, who I had great admiration for, and when he was in Kart, I said to myself, this is the only guy who could come in and beat Schumacher right now. And he came in and he did that. But when the chips were down, Jacques would let that be known. And I think he had a tendency to criticize the team and not remain optimistic the whole time, the way that Schumacher did. And that's something that really counts, I think. You know, I've seen it in drivers like Vettel as well. So, but of course, he's mostly been at good teams now, although Toro Rosso. So I think that applies to Raikkonen, and I don't think that's really one of Raikkonen's great gifts.
Talking of Michael Schumacher, two seasons without a podium finish. Has this been a surprise for you?
No. What has been a surprise for me is how extraordinarily well he has done. I mean, his stamina, his lap times, his racecraft. To an extent, there's a loss in the racecraft, but because, you know, there's it seems. I mean, he passed more cars than anybody else last year, as the statistics that were published at the end of the year showed. But that had a lot to do with the fact that he was qualifying low and leaping up on early laps of the race. Probably something happened in his racecraft in terms of how many times we saw the past 2 years where at some point early in the race, he would be way ahead of Rosberg. And then just sort of magically, out of nowhere, Rosberg is ahead of Schumacher. So there must have been some kind of, and of course, Rosberg always being a little bit faster. Not always, but much of the time. Now, I think, for me, it was extraordinary that a 41 and 42-year-old could come back and perform at this incredible level. I mean, what he's done is just extraordinary. But unfortunately, Rosberg has had the better, you know, more points, better performance, better qualifying, the edge. He's had the edge. And in this series, the driver that has the edge is the guy that they need. He's the guy who delivers at the end. And the other guy ends up getting bumped out or whatever. Now, in the case of Schumacher, though, I can see how he could be, despite being a little below Rosberg, you know, come what may, he's all of his experience, his technical understanding, and his ability to drive a team. I think these are things that, you know, to say nothing of his media, his name and what, I think these are all things that can only benefit Mercedes and benefit Rosberg in the long run. And I think that must be why they're keeping him. I remember a conversation I had with Bernard Doudot, and I've written about this before, Bernard Doudot, who was the brains mm-hmm. behind the Renault engine. And he said that when they worked with Schumacher at Benetton, Schumacher was, his technical input was better than Senna's, and it was better than Prost's. And he said that they did things, technical things, on the Renault engine. They came up with technical changes to the engine that they would never have done if it was not for Schumacher's input, and that they were changes that worked, that were important and valuable. So I think there's a whole lot of stuff that people don't see about what Michael must be bringing to that team. You know, and everybody's so used to seeing Michael Schumacher win all the time that on the surface of it, it looks as though he's not the man he was. But as far as I'm concerned, it's brilliant.
Yes, absolutely. Do you go to all the F1 races? Do you have any interesting story or moment you can share with us about your time in F1?
I'm not sure what you mean. There's so many different levels of what you're interested in. There's so many different levels to that. What particular area or what
relating mostly talking to a driver where he said something funny or some situation recently in the past.
Some kind of anecdote.
Yeah, or any experience you want to share. Doesn't have to be funny. Something went wrong terribly and you had to do some damage control or they had to do some damage control.
That's kind of funny because I probably should have given more thought to that before.
Or we can come to this question later on.
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Okay, so you are based in France. We had no French drivers in 2011. Now we will have three. Jean-Éric Vergne, do you think he is the French Sebastian Vettel in a few seasons?
It's kind of funny because I think that I'm too close to him to have a good idea. Because it turns out that, like, when he was 16 years old, so in other words, I'm a bit prejudiced in this because I know him better than the other two. When he was 16 years old, it was 5 years ago, I guess, I did this media event. It was the French Go-Karting Association, or it was the French Auto Racing Association that was putting together, just before the World Championships of Go-Karting, outside Paris, they did a media day, and they had journalists hooking up. It was a race, and each team comprised a journalist, a go-kart racer from the French team, and some kind of business person involved, like, I don't know, media or whatever. I can't even remember. So I was with them, and we won the race.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, I put this up on my blog at that time. And then, so from that time, I went to some karting event elsewhere, and I ran into him again, and then ran into him here and there, and started seeing him in the F1 paddock and all that. So I've actually followed his career closely and met up with him many times. And it was kind of funny also last year because I had this kind of problem where in the team he was in, his teammate was the Canadian, Robert Wickens. So I was kind of like, well, gee, and the two of them were fighting for the title. And I was like, oh, man, well, so who am I supposed to root for, my fellow Canadian or my fellow Frenchman? Yeah, so, well, Wickens won that title, but Vergne is in F1 this year. But I really can't say, I haven't seen enough of Charles Pic, and I haven't seen, I mean, Grosjean. I would say, you know, it's really hard to say who's gonna come out on top or where they stand. But I certainly have great faith in Vergne.
Yeah, Jean-Éric was out of control in British F3, and I could not believe how quick he was when Red Bull blew out Brandon Hartley in World Series by Renault, and Jean-Éric was like, boom. I think he did four races, three of them he was like on the podium or something like that.
I also used to go-karting at his parents' go-kart track, which is about 15 minutes drive from where I'm sitting right now at my home. Well, more like 20, 25 minutes. It's the best go-karting track outside of Paris in Calmy.
Wow. And, yeah, I will be in Paris in April. I think we should get together and do some cappuccino.
I'm drinking one of those right now at my home, as a matter of fact.
Are you
my Gaggia cappuccino machine.
And are you in main Paris or are you suburbs?
Just outside. Just outside of the suburb.
Okay, cool. You mentioned Robert Wickens. I'm a big fan of Jean-Éric and also Robert Wickens. Both are very good. What is the word on Wickens? Does he have something going this year in F1?
Well, I actually don't know. I don't know. That's one of the great things about my job, actually, is most of the Formula One journalists are connected to a national newspaper, and they have to write about their national drivers all the time. And one of the great jobs about mine is that, well, I'm writing for an American newspaper, it's true, or two American newspapers, but there's no American driver in F1. And as far as the International Herald Tribune is concerned, we are an international newspaper. And so the audience for the Herald Tribune is international. It's not, I mean, but it's also American, but the newspaper sees much of its goal. I probably shouldn't be talking about these things, but this is the way I see it, as being international. So I've never had to look specifically at one driver, a North American, American, or any. It's a great relief, because that way you get to write about what you really think is most important in the series. Wickens, I just don't know at the moment what's happening. I don't know. But a lot of people frequently come up to me and say, hey, what's happening at the U.S. Grand Prix? And I'm thinking, well, you know, I know as much about the U.S. Grand Prix as I do about the British Grand Prix or the Turkish Grand Prix. Or the,
Okay, you have a diploma in broadcasting from the National Institute of Broadcasting in Canada, and I understand you also had a 3-year career in show business. Please tell us how far you went in that. Big threat to David Letterman at any stage of your career?
Was I what?
A big threat to David Letterman?
Oh, yeah, it's kind of funny because I started out as a child performing, doing some theater, doing ventriloquism. And as a teenager, I started doing juggling and unicycling. And I joined a circus at 18 years old and did juggling, unicycling, and setting up the tent, wearing, you know, putting blisters in my hand, hammering stakes into concrete, which was one of the things I realized, you know, made the circus life was just not the glamorous thing I thought it would be. And I didn't really like to travel. But it's kind of ironic that I ended up in a circus again, the Formula One circus, traveling all over the world, but it's first class. So I then did, I left the circus very quickly, went into television. I seemed to have like a kind of golden touch or luck at that time because it was like, as soon as I left the circus, I said, I want to be on TV. And so in Ottawa, I went in one afternoon and knocked on the doors of 3 television stations, went in and said, I do juggling, unicycling, ventriloquism, music, acting, and I want to be on TV, but I'm willing to sweep your floors. By the time I got back home, my mother said to me, Brad, we've had a call from a television station, CJOH. And I said, oh, so this guy wants you to call him back. So I call him back. There's a guy named Gary Dunford, who was also a newspaper columnist at the Toronto Sun, but he was a writer and TV. He worked on this TV show. They were just putting together a TV show. It was going to start taping in a few weeks, but they wanted me to start the end of that week or the week after that to work both behind the scenes and on camera in a musical television program called Bang Bang You're Alive, in which I would do unicycling, juggling. I would be a moose. I would do some acting, and I'd work backstage. And it happened to be a massive production directed by a guy from the U.S. who was friends with the guy who ran the station. Had people like the Bay City Rollers on it. So I had dinner with the Bay City Rollers and chatted with them and the guy who ran their manager. People like John Sebastian from the Love and Spoonful was on it. Harry Chapin, who sang Cats in the Cradle. And,
yeah.
He was in it, and I met all these people, Melissa Muldaur, excuse me, all these great performers from the 1960s and 70s. It was an extraordinary thing, and it got me my actor card, which was essential, like the after card of the United States. It was essential to get on television. So as soon as I did that, I was in this 12-part series, and I went off to Toronto after. I was offered a job at the TV station, and I said, no, I'm going on to bigger things. So I went to the I went to Toronto, and I then went to. I was there for a question of a week, and I was playing in a comedy clubs and all sorts of things. Then went to the United States, to New York, to try and break into show business there. Found it much more difficult. Needed a green card. Almost married an American, making a huge mistake, but didn't do it. Finally, couldn't get any work there. Went back to Toronto. Did TV commercials, and I actually immediately got one of the biggest TV commercials of the time and in history, because it was called the Wear a Mustache Milk Commercial, which was founded there but ended up being repeated in the late 90s, I think, in the U.S. Huge thing. Did stand-up comedy, did film bit parts, did music, appeared in a film with, of all people, Kim Cattrall, who was my age, who ended up being in Sex and the City. You know, just as sort of, but I was very restless and I wasn't happy with it because I found that most of the time I was just waiting around for work, even though I had instant luck and lots of little jobs and things. And so I wanted to have something much more solid, and I moved to England to get into repertory theater, but I ended up busking because nobody wanted a guy who'd not been to theater school. And then I ended up as a bartender in the National Theatre there and working with the stars of the time, such as Albert Finney, Kate Nelligan, even people like Ralph Richardson, John Gielgud, Harold Pinter. I worked in the green room and served all these people. And that really showed me, that's when I changed my thinking and decided, no, theatre, TV, film, it wasn't for me. I'd started writing by then. And that's when I said, okay, I want it right. And so I kind of changed everything. Now, what's curious and interesting is that I put all those show business things to one side and said I'll never touch them again because I've got to concentrate on writing. It was journalism. It was books, you know. It took a while before I discovered the niche of the racing. And the curious thing now is that 3.5 years ago, I started playing music again. Everything came around in a circle, and I'm now performing regularly, playing music, playing my songs, playing cover songs, and I take my guitar to the races, and I find places to play at the races. And it's added, we're getting back to your anecdote situation in a way, except this is not about drivers. This is about the life of the Formula One journalist. And since I've started taking my guitar with me and performing at the races, it's been a really cool experience because I finally feel like I'm really discovering the countries that I'm going to and life in those countries. Because most of the time, my past as a Formula One journalist was the same as everybody else. It was airplane, hotel, airport, track, hotel, airport, that's it.
Do you play the Curtis Mayfield classic Gypsy Woman song I like very much?
No, I don't. No, the only Curtis Mayfield I know was that was Superfly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know that one.
Oh, Gypsy Woman is a fantastic song. You will love it.
Okay. But this thing has been very cool because actually, yeah, when I was in Malaysia last year, so I played in an open mic. And there was the talent coordinator of the biggest musical hotspot in Kuala Lumpur called the Backyard Cafe and Grill, saw me. He was at the open mic, and he asked if I wanted to come and play, do a gig at his place. And so I said, yeah. And that was, I guess I did it on the Monday after the Malaysian Grand Prix. It was, we were going to China at that point. So there were a bunch of journalists and people who had nothing to do on the Monday. And so I had some of the F1 people come in and listen. There was some journalists, Joe Sayward came, David Tremaine came, and Alex Yung came along to listen, you know, the Malaysian driver. And so what was interesting about that was that it opened up. This playing music at the races opens up a whole new, you know, kind of, at first it seemed like it was going off on a shoot in another direction, but actually it all comes around together. And one of the great things I love about the Formula One paddock, in fact, is the kind of people that you meet in the paddock. So you meet not just the drivers, but, you know, the engineers, people like Ross Brawn, the Mike Gascoigne. These are highly intelligent, trained engineers who all have the same competitive bug, which makes them, you know, quite interesting. But you also then have the stars coming through. You have musicians, Eric Clapton, who I met at the Belgian Grand Prix. You have, you know, people. I even had this sort of almost obscure musician. For me, it wasn't obscure, but it not many people remember Ken Hensley, who was a keyboard player for Uriah Heep, which was a big band in the early 70s. I ran into the guy I can't remember, but it was at a Grand Prix. It was long hair. He was in his early 60s, his long hair down his back. He had met editor of a German auto racing magazine, because most of so many musicians love racing. Turned out they had this, and he used to race, Ken Hensley. Now, Ken Hensley was there at this race, invited by the German editor of the German magazine to interview, I think it was Niki Lauda, but that doesn't make sense, perhaps. I can't remember. To interview a driver. And as a journalist. So we got chatting. I said, yeah, you're Ken Hensley. Yeah. And I said, well, man, me and my friends, we were like real fans of your music. You know, I bought your, that solo album of yours. I loved it. I can't remember the name now. And he said, oh, you're the one who bought that. I gave a copy to my mother and somebody else bought a copy. It was it was really funny. But anyway.
Did you ever invite Nicole Scherzinger for a cup of cappuccino in the paddock?
No.
Okay. As a North American living in Europe and covering Formula One, what is your advice to young, talented drivers from this side of the pond who harbor F1 aspirations?
Well, it's the same thing that everybody says. They've got to come to Europe. They've got to come to Europe because, I mean, they've got to come to Europe sooner or later. they're not going to make the mistake that Michael Andretti did of staying in the United States and going back and forth. Of course, it was a bit different at that time since most of the races were in Europe. But the problem is that Formula One is at the pinnacle. It is international. But I think these drivers have to grow up within the racing culture of the European lower formulae in Europe to immerse themselves in the style of racing here. But also, I think it's very important for them to meet the other people who are involved in the series, to be exposed to the other people. The whole, you know, I don't know what it is, 80% of Formula One is based around, in that area around London. And these people, they've got to be aware of these young drivers from a very early age, and they've got to mix with these people, see, they've got to be on the radar. That's really important. That's really important. And the racing itself, obviously, as I said from the beginning, they've got to be immersed in the European system, really. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, Wickens managed to get over here. He did race a lot in Europe. His early days were in Canada. Is there any reason, you know, I wonder, he won the championship last year. He's not an F1, but Verne is. Is it because of Verne's closer European contact? Of course, Verne has got the Red Bull, you know, backing. I don't know. I just think that they've got to be exposed as early as possible and as much as possible to the European thing. It's a little bit unfortunate in a way, because it's supposed to be an international series. And if these people are, if you're an American, but you're going to go grow up in Europe, you know, then are you American still? You know.
Yeah. Well, we had Harry Schell a long time ago.
Yeah. But in the past, it was different, of course.
Yeah. Okay, last question. Apart from Monaco, what is the race on the F1 circuit you would recommend to a race fan who was planning to attend his or her first Grand Prix?
Istanbul. It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
you know, Istanbul was Constantinople, and once upon a time they had a Grand Prix. Great place and a great track, I have to say.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so... Oh, there's just so many experience. I guess we're going to have to say, forgetting all such things as how much it would cost and all the rest of it. You know, that's a really hard question because they all have such character, such different character. But, I mean, I would say the ones that really stand out in my mind would be Japan, Australia, India. Yeah, because, Singapore. Singapore is wonderful because the culture is different, but you're downtown, you are exposed to a culture, you're exposed to nightlife, you're within walking distance or metro distance of the track, so you've got a complete thing going on there in Singapore. And you're also very close to the cars, like in Monaco, in Singapore. So that's really cool. The only problem is that it is hot as hell, but you can stay up all night and eat street food for about, you know, nothing.
Oh, wow.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, great. You know, I have to run to my day job now, but before I...
I'm sorry I talk so much.
I'm enjoying this. Actually, I want to do it more if that's okay with you some other day.
Okay.
Okay, how about a message to our listeners? We have listeners all over the world. And also, please tell them about the F1 blog you do, because that's how I got to know you, and I really enjoy reading that.
A message to the listeners?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well...
And please plug your employer and your blog, because we enjoy that.
Well, the listeners, the fans, like, without them, this doesn't exist. And also, I've met so many fans that know so much about this sport. It, like, keeps me on my toes, and I say, oh, man, you know, watch out. You gotta keep on your toes here, because they're going to know more than you are if you're not careful. But my Formula One blog is something that I've been doing for 6 seasons now, and I'm going to continue this year. And it's changed over the years. It was first on the IHT site, then it went to the New York Times site. It's fun though, because that's where I get to really, that's where I like to try to get to really put down the personal stuff and the inside stuff. When something happens, something weird, you can throw it down like that. There's also, I do my about.com thing as well, which I think you've seen. That's much, that's a whole encyclopedic sort of about Formula One. What is it? There's a blog on that site as well, but that's much less of the personal experience kind of stuff, more newsy. But I'm really incredibly excited. I'm going to go to every race this year. I'm just in the process of planning that out right now. Got the whole thing underway. I'll be doing special reports in the International Herald Tribune before each race, plus a season preview on March 10th, and a season review after the week after the season ends. And that's sort of from 2 to 4 pages of interviews, features, in-depth stuff, and real journalistic feature stories. So it's going to be another great season. I'm really looking forward to it. And I hope that Sebastian Vettel, like he said, it's going to be really close.
Yes, great. All the best. And I hope we have a great season. And
okay, thank you.
Have a great day.
It's been great talking to you.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport. A blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.